Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and thanks for being with us today. Going to be talking for the next hour about a variety of things. Got a very interesting show for you. Leading off will be Jessica Clement. She is Legislative Director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Had a lot of experience in Washington for somebody so young. And we're going to be talking about the Postal Service and the possible changes in it and how they may impact you as a non-postal federal worker. Going to be looking at the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, coming up for federal retirees in next January, the legislative outlook and her take on the most recent FDR Federal Dispute Resolution Conference. Then we'll switch over to Andy Medici. He's a senior writer for the Federal Times, and he's going to be talking about a number of very interesting projects he's been working on, including one that shows that federal workers are getting slightly richer and doing slightly better than they have been in a long time, despite a federal pay freeze. So we'll find out how that's coming about. Jesse, are you with us?
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you. I know Wednesday is a particularly bad day for you, so thanks for joining us. We, you and I had an interesting discussion earlier about the Postal Service, and we'll get to that. But first, you're fresh from the FDR, the Federal Dispute Resolution Conference in San Francisco. Always a good conference. I guess attendance was down this year, as it was last year, things being the way they are. But that's always a good place to kind of relax, chill out a little bit, and get to talk to federal workers in the hall and in meetings and at lunches and whatnot, the kind of thing you might not be able to do in D.C. or in the headquarters operation. What were people telling you, talking to you about?
Thanks for the opportunity to talk about the conference. We missed you this year. The Federal Dispute Resolution Conference brings in ADR, EEO, HR professionals, some union employees as well who hold leadership roles in their unions to talk about dispute resolution. You know, simply that every year for the last six, I believe it is now, I've done given a legislative update at the conference. So it's mostly a smaller group. This year, we had about 40 people in that session who were incredibly engaged. It was more of a conversation than it was, you know, a presentation of sorts. And the common theme in the room was, why does Congress hate me so much?
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
I don't think that's surprising at all. You know, you look at the last 3 to 4 years for federal employees, they've constantly been, you know, Congress's piggy bank. Every time they need to pay for something else, regardless of how important or unimportant that provision may be, they go to federal employees to pay for it.
Well, you know, I've noticed that over the years, politicians of both sides, but some time back there was a member of Congress who, a high-ranking member of Congress, who referred to, I believe, ATF agents as jackbooted thugs. And he was really, really on the case of federal law enforcement people. Well, lo and behold, in life's little ironies, in this case a sad one, potential assassins broke into the Capitol, were heading for him to his office to shoot him, and a couple of Capitol Hill policemen defended him. One died in the line of duty, and these were the same, presumably the same jackbooted thugs he had not liked a couple of months before.
Right. There is this ongoing disconnect between, you know, what federal employees do and what members of Congress think they do, if they even give it any thought at all. You know, I was watching the hearing from last week on the general schedule, and you hear these members, you know, of Congress tell stories, well, we brought in an EPA employee who did this, and at the IRS they did this, and they did this at the VA, as if everyone is going rogue, you know? You're going to have a few bad apples from time to time. The federal government is no different than any other workplace. But I would say the majority, even the vast majority, like upwards of 99% of federal employees believe in the work they do. They want to work for this country, and they can't understand why members of Congress don't get that.
Well, I wonder, too, sometimes it might pay for them to take a step back and look at this. Every statistic, every poll taken almost every year shows that Congress is held in as low a repute as you can get and still be on the chart. People don't like the House. They don't like the Senate. They don't like politicians. But that said, they keep reelecting the same people. So either there's something wrong, or else we have this human ability to say all congressmen are bad except mine. All dentists are crooks except mine. All lawyers are evil connivers except my next-door neighbor or my brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the common adage with Congress. Hey, Congress, love my congressman. You see it time and time again. And, you know, over 90% of them get reelected every single year. So you may dislike the institution, but most people keep coming back to reelect their members.
Yeah, yeah. I guess Eric Cantor being the notable exception
this time around.
Interesting reasons for that. Talking about the Postal Service, I did a column Tuesday, I think it was, about the fact that the Postal Service is looking at some major changes in the way it pays pensions and takes care of people, among them, and want to change the health system. They want to renegotiate the retirement plan and do a number of things. The response to it, particularly for July, when this is sort of the slow, silly season, the response was tremendous. Got a very nice email from a lady who said she was concerned about this and that she thought as the Postal Service goes, so goes the nation. I also got one from the Office of Senator Carper of Delaware, who is sponsoring one of these, and they very gently, I must say, nicely took me to task. I had said the plan would take the U.S. Postal Service workers out of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. What they said is it would create a new Postal Service health benefit program within the FEHBP, and it would require eligible retirees to enroll in Medicare. Also, I said they were going to eliminate the defined benefit, the FERS retirement program, for future postal hires. And the correction, they said, was the bill would allow the Postal Service and its employees to bargain over the design of pension benefits for a new Postal Service hires, presumably a 401k plan or something. What do you think about is this postal thing, is this isolated? Is this happening to them only, or does this have implications for other federal agencies?
As you mentioned, Senator Carper is the lead sponsor of the postal reform bill moving through the Senate. When we talk about postal reform at NARF, I always talk about it in the context of this Senate bill, because if there is going to be any postal reform that gets done this Congress, which is, at this point in time, is looking incredibly unlikely, it will be some version of this legislation. It's not going to be one of the numerous pieces of legislation ISO has introduced on the House side or one of the other two pending bills in the House and Senate. It will be this. So I think it's important that we talk about, you know, what is in this bill. And the staffer was right. The postal bill, as currently written, as passed by committee, creates a postal-only health benefits plan under the guise of FEHBP. This would be open to postal employees, retirees, and their spouses and dependents. As a postal retiree, you would be forced to enter into one of those plans. If you and your spouse, if they also receive healthcare through the Postal Service, would be required to enroll in Medicare Part B. It is this requirement that all but eliminates the Postal Service's pre-funding requirement, which is why it's in the financial situation it's in today. So that alone can all but eliminate this pre-funding problem that the Postal Service currently has. We have heard from no shortage of NARF members who retired from the Postal Service many years ago, who elected at the age of 65 not to enroll in Medicare because they felt their FEHBP coverage was sufficient, who now, 10 years later, have absolutely no interest into enrolling in Medicare. It is my belief that if this moves forward for the Postal Service, requiring all postal retirees to enroll in Medicare when they hit the age of 65, this is just the beginning for the rest of FEHBP.
Well, and the whole idea behind this, too, is to save money. But I want to hold that for a minute. Lauren Larson, who had a birthday earlier this week, is giving us the semi-hook. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
What does the landscape of public sector innovation look like, and what does this mean for innovators and those who study their efforts? How do awards programs promote innovation efforts? How can a climate for innovation be created in public organizations? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions with Professor Sanford Borens, author of the IBM Center report, The Persistence of Innovation in Government. Tune in on Mondays at 11 a.m. for the Business of Government Hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
The United States Navy Band presents outdoor concerts every week all around the Capital Region. Monday nights at the U.S. Capitol, Tuesday nights at the Navy Memorial and Sylvan Theater, as well as venues in Maryland, D.C., Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and more. Bring your family, enjoy great music, and support sailors deployed around the world around the clock. Visit us on the web to find out when the Navy Band is playing near you.
Friends, families, and teams, lace up your running shoes and meet me at the ballpark for the KC Cares 5K at Oriole Park. Hi, I'm Baltimore Orioles right fielder Nick Markakis. Join my family and me Saturday, August 2nd, as we kick off the event. You'll be running to help a critically ill child. Both the 3.1-mile race and the mile walk begin at Cannon Yards and actually end on the field. Visit kccares5k.org to register now.
When it comes to security, why have so many of your neighbors chosen Ackerman Security Systems? They researched the others, and here's why they chose Ackerman. Nationally recognized UL and CSAA 5 Diamond certified monitoring for just $18.95 a month. The only company with guaranteed response time. Free to switch your existing service. Experts in security for over 40 years. So start saving today and make the switch to Ackerman's $18.95 rate. And backed by popular demand in July, up to 6 months monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070 or learn more at AckermanSecurity.com.
And while you can't always be home, you can stay connected anytime, anywhere with Ackerman's Total Connect. It lets you control locks, thermostats, and lighting remotely with a tap on your smartphone or tablet. So remember to take advantage of the special extended offer and switch to Ackerman Security in July and get up to 6 months monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
The National Contract Management Association invites you to World Congress 2014, being held in Washington, D.C., July 27th through 30th. This training event serves as a neutral forum for government and industry contract management professionals. Expert speakers, customizable educational tracks, networking, and more. Visit www.ncmahq.org/events-wc for more information.
Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with Jessica Clement. She is Legislative Director for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. And I always think for someone so young, certainly young compared to me, Jesse's had so much experience. You've worked on the Hill. You worked as Legislative Director for the Federal Managers Association. So you've seen it on both ends. You've seen the sausage come in and how it's made and worked at various levels. So it's always good to get your take on things. We were talking about the Postal Service and its plans to reform it, and obviously it has to do something. There's email out there, there's UPS and FedEx, there are things we don't know about. Snail mail now has become a part of the language. A lot of people aren't using the mails anymore, and the Postal Service has to do something. It is very top-heavy in personnel costs. I think 9 out of every $10 in the Postal Service goes toward people. And when they talk about reform, most people think about cutting things. And while it's true that the Carper bill and others would keep federal workers and postal workers and retirees in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, and that's very important, but while it would keep them in it, it would, as you say, force the retirees to take Medicare, and that would throw a lot of the cost off to Medicare as opposed to the FEHBP, correct?
Yes. When you have, as an FEHBP participant, both Medicare and FEHBP, Medicare becomes the primary payer.
Right. Big deal.
So all your doctor bills are paid first by Medicare and then secondly by FEHBP. So it's a cost shift from FEHBP to Medicare, bringing the cost down for FEHBP.
Well, you know, Walton Francis, who's probably literally the world's leading authority on federal health plans, a longtime HHS official, served in numerous capacities in different committees, and he was on this show this time last year, and he said he did not see how the Postal Service could reform its health program, whatever the plan, without making it less expensive to them and either less desirable for employees or more costly to employees.
Absolutely. I mean, the Postal Service has a whole host of problems, but some of them, you know, could be easily fixable if Congress looked at this from a very different approach. You know, there are too many attempts to just take the Postal Service to five-day delivery, and somehow that will solve all their problems, which it's also not going to do, not to mention the service standards being decreased from an entire country who's used to receiving mail 6 days a week. We've lost sight of the conversation here and how to fix the Postal Service, and hopefully maybe next Congress we can get back on track.
Well, the thing I always thinking about is, and this harkens back to Ben Franklin days, the Postal Service was meant to unite us as a country before Route 66 and email and television. And the idea is I can send a letter from my home or my office here to Kodiak, Alaska, for a fixed price, the same that it would cost to go from Washington to Silver Spring. Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful subsidy in a big country like this. If you get a private carrier, A, they probably won't deliver to Kodiak, but if they do, it's going to cost you more than 50 cents.
And they're probably going to give it to the Postal Service to deliver that last mile anyway, which is what the Postal Service does for the big carriers like FedEx and UPS. They're also at a point where now the Postal Service is delivering packages for Amazon on Sundays. And other online retailers, Walmart in particular, are starting to pay attention. Maybe you know, who want to compete with Amazon for certain goods, you know, who's to say they won't be watching how this works to see if they want to also deliver packages on Sunday?
I'm waiting for the drones in the backyard. That's it. It's July, the dog days of July. We know that the Congress, and Al Kamen in the Post today, had an interesting and amusing column about the sort of the mandate that Congress take the month of August off. They're almost required to do it. But, you know, we're running out of time here. There's still time for the Washington Nationals to clinch the National League pennant. And Lauren, who covers our producer, who covers sports as well, we're convinced it's going to happen. But it is getting near to the legislative end of the year. And is there still time for Congress to do anything, or are you looking ahead to some time bombs coming up in 2015?
Well, we're always preparing for 2015 as we get closer to the start of FY16. But to answer your question as it relates to this year, so Congress has this week and next week left in session, and then they're in recess for 5 weeks. And as an organization that strongly encourages our members on the ground across the country to meet and find some time with their members of Congress, I can tell you these guys don't always get a break when they're back home for August. I don't expect much on the legislative calendar in the next week and a half. When we get back from August recess, they have almost all of September, although the House does have a week-long recess in September scheduled as well. And then we're at the start of the fiscal year. You know, we have October 1, begins FY15. We already have budget numbers laid out as determined at the end of last year. And appropriations through the House is moving pretty smoothly. I believe the House has passed 7 or 8 of their appropriations bills so far, but it's incredibly unlikely that any of those will get through the Senate and then through conference before we hit the start of the fiscal year. There were articles yesterday saying House leadership is already working on writing a CR.
Oh, so that continuing resolution, which has become the way of life for the last dozen or so years now.
It seems that way, so I don't think this year is any different. Plus, we already have budget numbers, so there was no big budget fights this year. I do think, depending on what happens with the Senate in the November elections, we could have a very, very interesting lame duck. I think if we are going to see postal reform this year, it could quite possibly be at the end of November and into December.
You know, this happens in these particularly off-year elections. People say we're going to have an interesting lame duck Congress. I think particularly if one political party loses control of a particular body, if the Republicans lost the House, which isn't likely, if the Democrats lost the Senate, but there could be some Nero-like fiddling at the very end just to sort of get even, huh?
Mm-hmm. I think there could be, like you said, most pundits are saying there's a 50-50 shot Republicans could take control of the Senate, which could mean that Democrats want to get some priorities done before they're no longer in charge of the Senate. I think it really remains uncertain, and we won't have answers until November 5th.
Coming up, it appears that federal postal military and Social Security retirees are going to get a 1.9% cost of living adjustment January 2015. It's not locked in stone yet, but it's looking good at 1.9%. And I know it near and dear to your heart is the big difference between a federal pay raise, which is looking like 1%, and a COLA, cost of living adjustment, for retirees, which, as you often articulately say, ain't a pay raise, right?
Yes, I thank you for allowing me to get on my soapbox with this.
Sure.
It is a pet peeve of mine. The federal employee pay raise, as dictated by the FEPCA law, which passed in 1990, the law that also created locality pay, is meant to close the gap between public and private sector salaries. It was not meant to provide federal employees with a cost of living adjustment. Now, everyone calls it a COLA. Don't get me wrong. I am up here on my pedestal screaming by myself. But that was not the original intention of the law that was passed in the 90s. There are very specific areas of this country where public sector wages are far beneath, you know, the market value of similar private sector jobs, and that was one of the reasons locality pay was created. This pay raise appropriated by Congress, should they see fit, or left to the president if Congress fails to act, if Congress is silent on the pay raise, was meant to close this pay gap, which now stands at roughly 35%.
I think that in a lot of cases, the non-specialized media, when they report about a federal pay raise, they refer to it as a COLA, really kind of out of ignorance. You know, they know lots of things about the Ukraine that we don't know, but this is our area of expertise, and it's not theirs, and they simply confuse it. I think a lot of politicians, on the other hand, intentionally confuse the issue because they'll say, I'm not getting a pay raise, folks, back home. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a cost of living adjustment, a mere simple catch-up with inflation, when in fact they are getting a pay raise.
It is a pay raise for them as well, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out that members of Congress have now been under a pay freeze for roughly, I think it's 5 years now.
I want to alert you. I know you have to have other fish to fry, but Monday I was a guest on Bob Lyons and Tammy Flanagan's show For Your Benefit, and the feature of the show, we interviewed two retired federal workers, both women, one from the West Coast, one from this area, and it was an absolutely fascinating thing about there is life after retirement, what they expected, what they didn't expect, how the government helped them, how they planned for their retirement. You know, this is real life. As they say about retiring and dying, you usually only do either one time. And it was interesting to hear it. And I think what struck me as interesting, we were talking about how current federal workers, not retirees, but current federal workers should join an outfit like NARF. And we had to do disclaimers. And it turned out that everybody in the room, myself included, and I've never been a federal worker, but everybody in the room, including me, were NARF members, which I thought would be a great recruiting gig for you guys.
Well, we certainly appreciate that. I listened to the interview after you alerted it to me. You know, there are so many facets to federal retirement and so many questions I think those nearing retirement or those who have just retired have, and they're not necessarily sure where to turn. In-house, we have a federal benefits department that is here to answer those questions that you can't seem to get answers to from anywhere else. I think it's one of the greatest benefits of NARF membership that frequently flies under the radar.
Well, thank you. I tapped into David Snell twice today already for questions. So really appreciate that. Thank you, Jessica Clement. We'll have you back. Got to take a short break here on federal your turn. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Experts have been talking about the promise of cloud technology for some time now.
The cloud will transform how America works.
You've also heard them talk about its advantages.
The cloud will reduce government costs and improve productivity.
And you've heard this.
The cloud will deliver security across the entire platform.
Now there's a cloud that delivers on those promises. Introducing AT&T Cloud Solutions for Government. Our portfolio of solutions provides agencies the confidence that comes with the security of the AT&T network, with end-to-end integration for greater security, reliability, and performance.
Government agencies will serve the nation confidently using the cloud.
Find out how AT&T Cloud Solutions for Government can give your agency the confidence that comes only with the security of the AT&T network. Visit att.com/gov/cloud. Designed to meet FedRAMP certification. AT&T, mobilizing your world.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by Airbus Group.
Suicides among active duty military have increased this year compared with the same time last year, but Pentagon officials, according to the Associated Press, are encouraged that more service members are seeking help through hotlines and other aid programs. Pentagon documents obtained by AP indicate there were 161 confirmed or suspected suicides as of July 14th, compared with 154 during the same period last year. I'm J.J. Green.
Just above the Potomac, an Airbus Dolphin helicopter helps the Coast Guard protect our nation's capital. At 35,000 feet, an Airbus A321 airliner comfortably connects 200 passengers from New York to L.A. Over 20,000 miles up, Airbus satellites transmit vital information to Homeland Security personnel down on the ground, where Airbus emergency call systems ensure that help is on the way. Airbus Group. We connect and protect at every level.
Advancing technologies that provide greater safety and performance in aviation. Augusta Westland is proud to serve the public by delivering state-of-the-art helicopters to Maryland State Police.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Brian Miller of Navigant, the former IG at the General Services Administration.
You know, you have to report facts as they are. I've had to deliver very bad news. It's not a pleasant thing to do. GSA had 12,000 employees. You go to any town in America of 12,000, you're going to have a jail because people do criminal things. They do very, very inappropriate things.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm going to be talking with Andy Medici. Andy is a senior writer with the Federal Times and is good enough to come on and bat cleanup here frequently on the show. Andy, are you with us?
Always a pleasure, Mike.
Hey, thanks for doing this. And listen, somebody forgot to tell you that these are the dog days. Things are slow because you've been burning it up here with some really good stuff. You had a very interesting piece, which I picked up, but I did give you credit for it. But the headline says, pay freezes accelerate GS grade creep. Now, to the uninitiated, grade creep would probably, you'd think of as a weird guy who sits in the corner of a cubicle and looks at you when he thinks you're not looking at him. But grade creep means something very different in the federal service, correct?
That's right. Really what it means is that people come into the government at certain levels, 1 through 15, and at certain point their job usually maxes out. A higher grade usually means higher, more responsibilities, or sort of a higher position within the agency. So grade creep is the idea that over time government jobs have been creeping up the grades for a variety of factors. And recently I explored the idea that it was a pay freeze. For the last few decades, government has been moving from clerical and administrative work and have slowly jobs with more expertise have been collecting near the top. But the last 4 or 5 years, it's been harder for employees to get raises and promotions. And that seems to have accelerated the number of employees who've been pushed into higher grades, like 12s or 13s. And a lot of people said that it's because managers are looking to give a promotion or a raise in a system that isn't really geared towards that right now. And because of that, they worked hard to try and get some of those grades up.
You know, you see that in public employees, and we've seen it in the Washington area in various police forces around here. They'll find out that police officers and people who man fire boards and things like that are making a huge amounts of money in overtime. And this is just a hidden pay raise. It's a way to give people more spendable income, despite the fact that maybe the counties, for financial reasons, have frozen pay or they're getting minimal pay increases.
That's correct. You know, in a lot of these jobs, you know, you'll have an employee that works really hard, but they've maxed out their steps. And then you come into a situation where for 3 or 4 years, there are no pay increases. And as a manager, you want to keep that employee. You want to do whatever you can. And in some cases, the only way is to move them maybe from an 11 to a 12. And that's just because the system as it currently is, it's harder and harder to give bonuses and things like that as well, because Congress is really closely eyeing performance awards.
Well, you know, back in the day when I started on this beat, there were GS-1s and GS-2s and GS-3s. My mother came to Washington to work in the Pentagon, and she was a GS-2 working in the Pentagon, a clerk typist with, I think, Army Intelligence. So there were people like that. There are very few GS-1s and 2s now. But back then, one way to give people a pay raise when they weren't getting decent raises or when they came in at such a low starting salary was to promote them, and either a GS grade or a step increase. And so we were always tracking grade creep as if it were some sort of insidious insect that was creeping up the East Coast to destroy us. But I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, a little bit of that's changed now because the government, I suspect there aren't any GS-1s anymore in the government.
I actually looked this up just out of curiosity the other day, and there are about 20
really? Okay.
Left in the government. But, you know, a lot of them are going to be...
they're special programs, I
right, exactly. So in terms of the people that you or I might encounter, there's a very low chance of ever meeting a GS-1.
Well, I know at one time after World War II, I think it was, they reserved GS-2 and 3 jobs. They were messenger jobs for military veterans who were literally physically and emotionally damaged during the war, but they could handle that work, and that was created. But that's gone with the wind now, and your piece has just some startling numbers and great charts in here. But you said for the first time, more than half of all GS, that's general schedule, white-collar workers, are within grades 12 through 15. And that's, you're talking about, what, $80,000 to $155,000?
That's generally in that area.
That's a lot of money.
Exactly. And I think this is one of those situations where the debate's really complicated because a lot of higher technical, higher expertise people tend to cluster at the top. And when you have situations like this, it's almost impossible to figure out who's paying what. And that debate continues in terms of whether the government pays, underpays, or overpays. And we've talked about that before. And it's impossible to really come to a consensus on that. So John Palguda over at the Partnership for Public Service said that this is really just management acting rationally in the face of an irrational situation, which is they're working within this established longtime system. And the system has some flaws, and those flaws have gotten worse. But at the same time, it's probably better than any alternative that Congress could come up right now if they wanted to.
Well, it seems to me, you know, having watched the evolution of the government over the years, the mission of the government has changed so much, and it's become so professional, so technical, so administrative. I mean, there was a time when you could go into a government building and you saw rows and rows of government clerks, mostly men, with green eye shades, literally, you know, not with quill pen. I don't go back that far, but they were a lot of clerical jobs. Those are gone with the wind now. And Uncle Sam, as I'm fond of saying, doesn't do retail, so you don't have the big lots and the Walmarts and that kind of thing. The government does not do stuff like that. What it does do is things like the CIA and DARPA and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and some of these high-level, highly professional organizations. And, I mean, that would create to grade creep, but it's not necessarily a bad thing or a wrong thing, huh?
That's correct. You know, the government has become more highly technical and highly specialized, and that expertise is increasingly crowding at the top. And you're right, you know, there are cybersecurity experts, medical professionals, engineers, law enforcement officers and law enforcement experts. But at the same time, those are people that in many cases the government can't pay as well as the private sector. And in that sense, a lot of the steps, even at the higher levels, either aren't enough or aren't sufficient. So agencies are forced to carve out, you know, special pay authorities for those people as well. So you kind of have the GS system, which is sort of stuck in the 1 through 15, and then there's a variety of special pay structures, too, for trying to get these people more pay. So a lot of people are frustrated with the GS system, but at the same time, there doesn't seem to be a lot of consensus on how or what or even whether it should be replaced for something else.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I wanted to ask you something about that. But, you know, when you look at what the government does now, I was recently coming back from vacation, sat next to a lady, very nice lady. Her husband works for NASA. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and his team tracks asteroids, and their big fear is an asteroid coming out of the sun, so we won't see it. You know, it's hidden there, and we won't see it, and it'll just get us. But she was talking about this and the high level of the people and the math involved and the astronomy and whatnot, and as we were leaving the plane, she said, you know, if you see my husband on the front page of the Post, you're toast. I mean, that, you know, that's the kind of job he's going to be announcing. It's all over, folks, you know. And you don't get that in the private sector. It's unique to government. And you look at a place like the National Institutes of Health, I always think of Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's, you know, just is a marvelous human being. The government couldn't pay him the equivalent in the private sector. He must like the view from his office, and he must like his work because to stay there.
You know, in a lot of ways, that's true, but that some of that is actually coming apart. You know, the government has had a monopoly, for example, on space travel for the longest time. But, you know, years and years of budget cuts and other projects at NASA have led to the creation. You know, there are several other private space companies that are forming now. And eventually you're going to have a situation where NASA is truly competing with private companies for people to, you know, for astronauts, for people who can do that high level math for satellites, for space travel. And so this is one of those situations where, you know, a lot of people that might have gone to the government for that special mission, that unique mission that only government can provide, maybe in 5 or 10 years, they might decide to go to the private sector because there might be better pay and the same kind of mission.
Well, that's an excellent example, and I think of it every time I see a space mission or a rocket, and now with the problems. Problem is a weak word indeed. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. and the rest of the world is that now we depend on the Soviets, the Russians, to get us into and out of space. We don't do that anymore. The decision was made not to do that. So we have to hitch a ride on a Russian rocket to get to a space station or something.
Well, in a lot of ways, this all comes back to the debate about what should our government do and what shouldn't it do. And when it came to NASA, you know, there just didn't seem to be the desire to fund those sorts of payload missions, and a lot of people didn't see the point. But of course, when it comes down to crunch time and you have a power that, you know, is sometimes aggressive or sometimes hostile to us, then it becomes clear why maybe we had done that in the past when we could have handed it off to someone else. And that really boils down to what is inherently governmental for us and what we think or at the time should be either contracted out or done by the private sector.
Well, there has been speculation that, you know, we put visa holes on various members of Putin's elite, Soviet President Putin's elite, and that he might come back and say, the next time you go to the space station, I'm sorry, we don't have room. Speaking of that, Lauren's giving us the signal again. Have to take a short break. Be right back talking with Andy Medici here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington are a positive place for kids. They support the development of young people who are most in need. Hi, I'm Renthia Ross, Vice President, GEICO Insurance Company. GEICO supports youth organizations that make graduation from high school and furthering skills for work or going to college a priority, like America's Promise and their partners, Boys and Girls Clubs of America. Help a kid grow up great. Give to the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington at bgcgw.org.
Here's Gail Kolplesch, Director of Federal Health Architecture, HHS, on the Federal Executive Forum on Health, IT, and Government, sponsored by NetApp.
Well, you know, the Federal Health Architecture vision is to support the development of the federal health information technology environment that's fully interoperable, and it supports not only the President's health IT plan, but the doctor's health IT plan and what's right for the citizens.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
The cloud may still feel a little foggy, but one thing is clear. You need to have options to answer your concerns about cloud security. With the world's number one branded storage operating system, your agency can deploy any combination of public, private, or hybrid clouds based on your mission and the sensitivity of your information. NetApp Storage allows you to store, move, and secure data across all cloud environments with ease, no matter how much your data grows. To learn more, visit netapp.com.
It's another early morning in Jim's neighborhood. Kids are heading to school, folks are walking their dogs, and here's Jim, just getting home again after another long night. What will his family say this time? Thanks. That's because Jim spent the night on duty at his local Montgomery County Volunteer Fire Department, protecting his neighbors and family. Are you willing to lose some sleep in order to make a difference? Learn more at joinfirerescue.com. That's joinfirerescue.com.
When it comes to federal IT networks, it's time to say goodbye to the status quo and start a new conversation about the network. Join government IT and the industry experts at the 2014 Federal Forum as they share their insights and best practices on how to implement and manage federal agency networks of tomorrow. The 2014 Federal Forum, presented by Meritalk and Brocade, August 13th at the Ronald Reagan Building. Register today for this complimentary event at federalforum2014.com.
I have this dream where companies around the country look to me to protect their IT networks. Every day, I'm putting programs and technologies in place to stop malicious intrusions and secure information assets. Soon I'm... Hey, who said it was a dream? I'm doing this now, and my master's degree in information assurance from Capital College made it happen.
Get the expertise you need to be a cybersecurity authority today at Capital College. The online master's program in information assurance provides in-depth training in management and analysis to build secure systems. Capital also offers a doctorate program and is recognized as a National Center of Academic Excellence in Information Assurance Education by NSA and DHS.
Capital College made my dream come true. It isn't for everyone, but it's perfect for me.
For a virtual info session on graduate programs at Capital College, visit capital-college.edu. That's capital with an O-college.edu.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Get the latest news on over 90 different agencies. Check out FederalNewsRadio.com's new agency page for the news most important to you. Find it at FederalNewsRadio.com.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn, talking with Andy Medici, the senior writer with the Federal Times. And Andy, we're talking about improving the civil service and reforming the GS system, and there have been hearings or whatnot. And I recalled and rewrote something, some history. I went to a conference several years ago. John Barry was the director of Office of Personnel Management, and you remember he's probably as well qualified as anybody that's ever come into that job, you know, for a variety of reasons, both his experience and his education and his enthusiasm. And he, to the surprise of a lot of his staff, announced that they were going to overhaul the GS system, and they were going to bring it down to three levels, grades, if you will. And I think it was apprentice, journeyman, and expert. And they were explaining how this would work. And since it was John Barry, and President Obama had been inviting him to cabinet meetings and saying he wanted to make the civil service cool again, I thought maybe this is going to happen. And never heard from again.
Well, I think that's one of those things where there might have been a bit too much optimism, because no matter how much the government wants to reform the civil service, almost every large-scale action would take an act of Congress. And in 2009 and 2010, Congress became increasingly hostile towards administration priorities. And we saw that over time, and that grew into things like the pay freeze and pension contribution increases. So we're at a stage where we still think, or most people, you know, want there to be some changes, but whether Congress will ever move on any of it is pretty doubtful.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It would require an act of Congress, and we had something like that with the National Security Personnel System in defense. The Bush administration people said this is the way to do it. We can reward the good performers. We can sort of gig the non-performers and remove those who aren't doing well at all. There was immediate opposition to it from the unions. They managed to block it at Homeland Security. I think through via federal court. Defense decided to have the project go ahead, but they took all union members out of it. So these were only people who were in units that were not represented by a union, primarily American Federation of Government Employees, but I guess Federal Managers Association as well. The program went along for a couple of years. Some people got much better raises than they would have under the GS system. But in the end, the unions and the Democrats said it was a bad thing. And as soon as President Obama was elected, they did away with it. So we had, quote, reform, depending on how you use the word reform. It didn't work. And it seems like we've tried this before, and they'll do it in a particular agency, and then it disappears.
I think the lesson that a lot of people have taken away from that is that if there ever is any kind of comprehensive reform, it has to be that comprehensive. It has to be government-wide, and it can't just affect one or two agencies. But you always run into that same roadblock, which is if you create a new system, do you move everyone into it? Does that mean some people get less pay, some people get more pay? Is it hugely disruptive to the system? And then how long do you stay in that system to make sure it's working or to decide if it's working? You're right, the NSPS, I think it lasted a couple years. And then they transferred back out of it. And, you know, to call back on history, there was an attempt in the Carter administration to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. That didn't last as long as people wanted to either. So do you stick with it? Do you transfer everyone into it? And do you accept the repercussions that come from that? And Congress so far has only nibbled around the edges in terms of tackling one agency for pay or one agency for pension stuff. And there is a desire to do more, but if you trust Congress to make a system better than the current one, you know, that's a gamble a lot of people aren't willing to take.
Well, you know, politicians, I guess, by nature are suspicious people of everyone's motives and particularly the opposition's. And I remember one time talking to a very high-ranking federal official who had dealt with federal retirement issues for most of his career, highly respected. This is a guy that wouldn't talk out of school. He didn't give the store away, but he was extremely honest. And after he retired, we stayed in touch. And he said at one point that in his tenure, and he'd been there for something like 30 years, there hadn't been a single piece of legislation involving federal retirement that passed the Congress that didn't personally benefit a member of Congress, maybe in one case a guy was having a messy divorce, or some prized staff member. And I think when people look at something like grade reform, they're looking for who do I know is going to benefit out of this?
I think that's a big problem too, because there has to be a lot of trust if you ever want to do it. And you know, from the point of view of unions and other employee groups, you have a system right now that it might not be the best and it might have some flaws, but at least you know how it works, you know the details, you know the ins and outs of the system. And for a lot of people, it's the devil you know rather than the devil you don't when it comes to whether or not you want a new system. And there's a lot of distrust among all the parties involved, because unions don't, for the most part, don't trust Congress enough to craft a new system that would be better than the old one. And of course, Congress has done a lot over the last few years targeting federal employees. So there's not a lot of trust left when it comes to these sorts of systemic reforms.
We're running out of time here with Andy Medici from the Federal Times. But Andy, we've all reported on the fact that Air Force is going through several rounds of buyouts and whatnot. Are you hearing talk about rifts, actual rifts in the federal agency?
So I think the way it goes now is they have a certain goal for reductions, and they're going to offer voluntary outs, like early retirements and buyouts. And from what I've been told is that if they don't reach those numbers, they will consider some rifts, although it will more than likely be a relatively low amount. But it is something that the agency is considering. And
this is Air Force now, correct?
This is Air Force right now.
Okay, which is likely that at least maybe some of the other military agencies would follow. Now, the problem, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the problem with a RIF is that They may want to get rid of the old-timers, the older men who are military veterans, but they're the last to go because of veterans' preference, seniority protections, and other things. If they want to fire me, they will fire me, but I can go down and bump you because you're younger and presumably a non-veteran. I mean, that's a problem, isn't it?
I mean, I think the agencies would rather use a scalpel instead of a sledgehammer, and that's what a RIF is. It's just blunt. And it does some damage when you use it. So I think a lot of agencies would rather reach the numbers they want to reach with early retirements and with buyouts. And early retirements definitely target the population of people that they want to. And some federal employees are eager to grab that early retirement if they can.
You get the sense that people are waiting for phased retirement before they make their move?
I think there was a lot of energy into that over the last few months. But it seems that lawmakers have been banging their head against the wall. I think there are some people that are holding on because they're not fully ready to leave the agency, but I think that number is going to go down as people look at their finances and they make those decisions based on, you know, what's going on right now and not whether OPM will do something in the future.
Well, and as private companies eliminate pension plans and cut back on contributions to employer retirement 401k plans, being a Fed as a career looks better and better all the time, doesn't it?
Well, that's the thing. Even with some of the increases in pension contributions, which have been pretty steep for new employees, the idea of a defined benefit plan in the private sector is almost non-existent now, and it's almost entirely switched to defined contribution. So for some people, that security, knowing later in life you'll have, that's very important.
I called my old company one time and asked when is the last COLA that retirees from that particular company had gotten, and the head of HR said, "What's a COLA?" So that was the answer to my question.
I think in the private sector now, you've seen a lot of that have been stripped away from the workforce.
Yeah. All right. Andy Medici, thank you so much for being with us. Hope to talk to you next week.
Always a pleasure.
Everybody have a good week out there. Be careful. Thank you, Lauren Larson. And we will be back here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Remember, our shows are archived on our homepage. So if you want to listen again, hope you do. That's the way to do it. Tell a friend. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.